Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Which movies belong on your must-see list this month? Studios often save what they think are their most award-worthy films for the end of the year, the better to keep them fresh on the minds of voting members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So today, I've invited the co-hosts of KERA's Big Screen podcast to share their impressions of the season's crop of important films. Chris Wagner is a pop culture writer for the Dallas Morning News. Stephen Becker is with KERA, and of course, he produces this show. You can find the Big Screen podcast online at artandseek.net. Guys, welcome back to Think.
Hey, Chris.
Thanks, as always.
All right, we might as well dive right in here and talk about what have you seen over the past few weeks that you think is the most exciting movie to tell other people about? Like, is there one that you're saying, this one you have to see?
There's a few that come to mind. I mean, I always tell people my taste might not be exactly the same as their tastes, but I'm a big Foxcatcher fan. I think it's a very sort of tragic look at the American dream gone horribly wrong.
This is the Steve Carell film.
Yeah, Steve Carell as John E. DuPont with a large prosthetic nose, and Mark Ruffalo and Channing Tatum as the Schultz brothers, real-life wrestling brothers. I just really liked the atmosphere and the mood, and pretty much just thought it was a very, very smart film. I like The Imitation Game a lot. That's coming Christmas, I believe. That's the Benedict Cumberbatch, I love saying his name, as Alan Turing. And it's about the team that cracked the Enigma code during World War II. Just a different kind of World War II movie with a really different kind of World War II hero. So I'm a big fan of both of those.
The one I keep going back to as far as the films that have come out in the last few months is Birdman. It's just incredibly visually inventive. It's about this actor played by Michael Keaton who essentially self-funds this Broadway project as a way of getting back in the good graces of critics and the industry, like a lot of Hollywood actors do. It's very meta in that way. In fact, he's a former superhero, or he played a superhero in the movies, much like the real Michael Keaton did. And it's just the most incredibly visually captured movie I've seen in a very long time. The camera almost never moves. It's hard to describe without seeing it, but you feel like you're constantly perched on maybe the shoulder of somebody walking behind the action. And it just is the most kinetically energetic movie I've seen in a very long time.
It seems like that one was marketed in a way that made it seem like a really goofy comedy rather than what you're describing.
Well, you know, if you go by the Golden Globe nominations, which came out today, it was nominated in the comedy category. And while there are certainly funny parts to it, there's also a major suicide that takes place in it, and there's lots of dark elements to it. So, you know, those marketing of movies are all about getting people in the theater, you know, in any ways necessary. And then from there, they'll show you the real deal, of course.
Yeah, they make Foxcatcher look like this heroic American story, when in fact it's sort of the complete inverse of that. They just want to get people in the seats.
Steve Carell's doing some really interesting things with his career they've been surprising to me, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly his most interesting to date. There's nothing funny about the performance. It is a straight dramatic performance, and he pulls it off really well. It's I keep going back to the nose because it's extremely noticeable. But yeah, it is as much as it's anybody's movie, it's his. Mark Ruffalo is always fantastic, and he's very good in it as well.
And you could see that Steve Carell had this in him if you kind of look over his last few movies, most notably The Way, Way Back, which was a pretty small movie that not a lot of people saw that came out last summer, in which he plays a kind of jerky, not stepfather, but boyfriend of this young boy's mother. And so you can see, like, wow, this guy has more to him than just, you know, Michael Scott from The Office.
Yeah, that movie was a real surprise. In fact, I went in, like, expecting, in the first shot, I thought it was going to be really funny. And then suddenly his character really turns on a dime, and it's revealed that he's actually an awful, awful person.
Yeah, in the very first scene of the movie, he asks his It's, again, it's not his stepson, but this potential stepson. You know, how he rates himself, and the kid says, oh, you know, I'm maybe about a 7. And he says, nah, I think you're more like a 3 or 4. It's like, what a terrible thing to tell a kid.
Well, it's a terrible, and the movie took you by surprise because at first you think there's going to be something funny, and then you realize, no, that's how he's talking to this kid the whole time. Okay, so Stephen, I have to talk about this. You gave me a copy of American Sniper to watch, and boy, I was astonished. Have you seen it, Chris?
I have.
Bradley Cooper is like unrecognizable. Physically, he's transformed. And I mean, I've sat as far away from the real Chris Kyle as I'm sitting from you two right now. And I think the performance is incredibly true to life.
Yeah, yeah. I thought he was fantastic.
To think that this is the same guy who, you know, had his hair permed last year for American Hustle, and the year before was this manic in Silver Linings Playbook. I mean, he really shows with American Sniper, which, as you mentioned, is the Chris Kyle story, who, of course, is the most, I don't know how you would, he's one of the all-time snipers in American history, to be able to play all of those characters and actually have a very convincing, I thought, Texas accent, of which I feel like I'm a connoisseur of at this point. He really showed a pretty incredible range.
I think he's a little bit better than the movie itself. I think it is a really good performance. The parts of the film I like best, even though the term PTSD never comes up, it is very much a film about PTSD. It's a film about trying to adjust to being back in civilian life after living in this world of combat, not just a world of combat, but a world where your job is to kill people. That is your only specific job. I thought it was very powerful in that sense.
And it's directed by Clint Eastwood, and a lot of the power comes from the way he cuts the movie. I'm sure that also involves the editor, of course, but there are these very fierce, overpowering battle scenes where it's just this swarm of energy, and then it's an immediate cut. And it's back to Chris Kyle back at home, just, you know, staring at a TV or sitting at a bar. And it really underscores the huge change in scenery that somebody who's been through action like that must have to deal with when all of a sudden they're back home and in seemingly a comfortable environment, but one that doesn't feel comfortable to them.
And I thought Eastwood made an interesting choice in that you could have set this up, based it on the memoir, but set it up on, is he going to get the shot every time that he needs to get to save these American troops? And there's really none of that. You almost come to expect that this is going to happen, and then it's really about the repercussions for him and for the people around him, as opposed to the drama of, like, aiming a gun and is he going to hit the mark?
Yeah, and it portrays him as a hero. It's a tricky kind of story because it is trying to show those repercussions that you mentioned, Chris, and also show the pure heroism. And I think Eastwood really believes in that pure heroism, and at the same time, he has to sort of pay heed to the human consequences of all that. So he has to walk that line. I think he does it pretty well. I think it probably could have lost about 20 minutes and been a much better told story, but I think you can say that about almost any Clint Eastwood movie from the past 10 years or so.
He's now 85 years old. Is there anybody else? I mean, even Woody Allen's 15 years younger than that, right?
Nobody currently American. I mean, Godard is up there.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we just lost Mike Nichols, of course, who was in his early 80s.
And there's some other international filmmakers who are, you know, approaching there. Bergman kept going, you know, in some way, shape, or form until pretty late in life, but I don't think he made it quite as far as Clint has. Yeah, I mean, Clint's just going to keep going, and they're going to have to – he's going to die on the set someday. I mean that in the best possible way. He is going to keep making films until he's gone.
With all due respect.
Absolutely.
All right, Unbroken, the first film directed by Angelina Jolie. Is that right?
I believe she directed a small film last year that I can't remember the title of, but this is certainly her first big-budget Hollywood movie. It's about – it's the story of Louis Zamperini, I believe is his name, who was a American POW in World War II in the Pacific Theater. In fact, he is a guy who survived this incredible plane crash into the ocean, floats around for more than 40 days, and is rescued by a boat of Japanese soldiers. So it's sort of, I mean, it's the epitome of out of the frying pan and into the fire. And it's about his perseverance story that really is pretty expertly captured. I mean, you you feel all of those. I mean, there's lots of torture scenes. It's nothing too graphic because the film actually is rated PG-13. And she's talked about how, you know, she brought it probably right up to the line of PG-13, but she wanted people to be able to see the movie and not kind of exclude people who are, you know, who can't get into a rated R movie.
I'm always happy when a female director is not doing an exclusively like movie for ladies. Like this, this movie seems to have general appeal, and maybe that speaks to the power of her stardom and her access in Hollywood.
I think there's only maybe one woman in the whole movie who has a speaking part, and it's Louis's mother. And other than that, of course, it's all men in these prisoners' camps. And she, you know, not to get too far ahead of ourselves on award season stuff, we've got another show to do maybe down the road for that, but there's a strong chance that she might get nominated in the Best Director field. She was not nominated in the Globes that were announced today, but it's a for all the reasons that you said, it's great that she's getting recognition for this because she's showing, like you said, that she's not just going to tell girly movie stories. You know, she can really tell these very masculine stories.
I haven't seen the movie yet. I hope it's good. I hope I like it. I hope she gets nominated if the movie's great. I mean, that's really sort of where I come down on that. If the movie is worthy, then she should absolutely be nominated. But I would like that to be the reason why she is nominated.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, women directors in Hollywood. Manola Gadar, just for the New York Times, is doing this three-part series about the underrepresentation of women on sets. And, you know, just looking back, I looked just for grins. I looked back since 2000. There's only been two women nominated in the directing category. And that's, you know, dozens of other men, of course, have been nominated in that time. Catherine Bigelow, of course, won a few years back for Zero Dark Thirty. But that just seems kind of ridiculous that half of the movie-going population is, of course, women, and yet they're so underrepresented in people to tell their stories.
Selma's directed by a woman.
Yes, absolutely.
What did you think of that film?
I liked it. I want to see it again. There's a lot there. It's certainly the most accurate and respectful big movie about the civil rights movement.
What do you mean
that
by
we've
that?
Had? Most Hollywood movies about the civil rights movement have a white hero of some kind, and they sort of become the facilitator of the action. And one could look at that as a cynical ploy to get a mass audience in to see the movie. One of the things I really appreciate about Selma is that it certainly acknowledges the role that a lot of white people played in the civil rights movement, but it is Martin Luther King's story. It is John Lewis's story. It's Ralph Abernathy's story. It's the people that were really there on the front lines. And it's not, you know, I've used the phrase white and shining armor before to describe some of these other movies. I'm thinking of like Ghosts of Mississippi and Mississippi Burning. Yeah. I think those are the two main culprits. This is a much different kind of film than those.
And are there discoveries to be made in the movie for people who think they know this bit of history?
I don't think people who have seen, say, Eyes on the Prize will be surprised by anything, but it's a really good dramatic distillation of those events, especially, you know, the climax. I don't think I'm spoiling anything. It's the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the marches, I should say, which were, you know, full of a lot of, you know, police brutality and just very tumultuous events. It portrays those events very, very powerfully.
We're speaking this hour with Chris Vogner of the Dallas Morning News, where he writes about pop culture, and Stephen Becker of KERA. They are, of course, co-hosts of KERA's Big Screen podcast. We're talking about year-end movies and the ones that you might have missed earlier in the year. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
Who is this guy?
He used to be Birdman.
It doesn't matter. The sport of wrestling is a low sport, and I don't like to see you being low.
Why is there nobody in the gym?
Yeah, no, I can't.
You ungrateful ape.
From the sound of your own voice.
You get lonely. I'm lonelier in my real life than I am out here.
Follow the avalanche.
Must have been some breakup, huh?
Breakup is sort of a shorthand.
Little movie montage there. You heard Birdman, Foxcatcher, and Wild. My guests this hour are co-hosts of KERA's Big Screen Podcast, Stephen Becker of KERA and Chris Wagner of the Dallas Morning News. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Lots of people are talking about Wild. People loved the memoir, and it sounds like a lot of people have enjoyed the movie. What'd you guys think?
I liked it a lot. I think I liked it more than most of, I think all, most of my brethren liked it as well. I really liked it. I connected to it. I just loved the visual style. I thought it was just a very visually poetic film and a really powerful story. That opens this week. That actually opens tomorrow. I gave it the rare straight A review. And I usually do that when I'm trying to say, go see this movie.
And it's, of course, the story of Cheryl Strayed, who was on the Think Show not too long ago. And her just kind of quest to cleanse herself, I guess, by going on this 1,000-mile hike of the Pacific Coast Trail. I saw it listed in the descriptions of the Globe nominations as the hiking drama Wild, or something about the hiking drama kind of makes me laugh. But yeah, it's Reese Witherspoon playing Cheryl Strayed, and it's directed by the same guy who directed Dallas Buyers Club. And the thing I was most impressed by with this film is it really easily solved what I kind of refer to as the castaway problem. You know, you've got one person by themselves on a hiking trail. There's not a lot of opportunity, you would think, for interaction or even dialogue, but the film is really beautifully put together in a way that it just sort of seamlessly flows back and forth from her time on the trail to all the things that kind of put her on the trail in the first place.
And she does encounter several people on the trail as well, and I think that's part of the power of the film too, is just how she sort of starts to judge these people and then realizes that they are not at all who they appear to be, for both, you know, good reasons and bad reasons, fellow travelers, fellow hikers, people, you know, that help her along the way or even menace her along the way. It's also a really good Reese Witherspoon performance, you know, and it's becoming cliche to say, oh, it's a different Reese Witherspoon. It is a different Reese Witherspoon. She seems like a different kind of actress. She seems a lot earthier, not quite, you know, the word perky has.
She's not America's sweetheart necessarily in this film.
Yeah, she's not playing with that idea, you know. I loved Election, where she's sort of skewering the idea of being America's sweetheart, but I think she is continuing to grow as an actress.
Part of the impetus for the real Cheryl Strayed taking that trip was that she was coping with the death of her mother, and I was surprised to hear that Laura Dern was cast as her mother simply because she seems a little young for that, but I guess people get older and I don't think about it.
Laura Dern is in her 50s now. She looks remarkable for being in her 50s, I must say. I saw her, she was at the Toronto Film Festival for the screening. I was like, wow, Laura Dern, nice.
And Reese Witherspoon still looks young enough that they can kind of young her up, you know, when she's playing across from Laura Dern and kind of expand on whatever age difference there may actually be between the two of them.
We have a tweet here from Steve who wants to know about The Imitation Game.
The Imitation Game to me is just a really good example of a certain kind of historical Hollywood film. It's kind of inspirational, but also has a lot of meat on its bones. It's a really good screenplay.
What's this one about?
This is Alan Turing, the Enigma code cracker who had to live his life largely as a secret because he was a closeted gay man in England at a time when such things were very much illegal. And he, very antisocial, almost Tourette's antisocial, has to sort of learn how to work with this team to, you know, really ultimately, you know, they had as much to do with winning World War II as anybody else, probably.
This has been a year for me where I feel like some of that a good number of the acting performances are actually better than the movies themselves. I think Imitation Game qualifies. I personally think Foxcatcher qualifies. I know we have a little difference on that one. I think Wild in some instances qualified, and I really think that holds true for The Theory of Everything, which I know we're going to talk about in a little bit.
This is the Stephen Hawking.
That's the Stephen Hawking movie. But with the Imitation Game, it also is, I think that's also the case where Benedict Cumberbatch gives you this really multi-layered, deep performance. I mean, you can kind of see the wheels turning in his head while he's thinking about how to crack the Enigma machine, but also while he's thinking about how to deal with this life that he's set up for himself, where he just kind of spontaneously gets engaged as a way, kind of a cover for him, kind of a cover for someone else. But the issues I have with the Imitation Game, which is definitely worth seeing, but big surprise, they cracked the code. Hate to break it to, you know, don't mean to have any spoilers there, but once they crack the code, that opens up all of these other questions for them, because they know how to stop so many potential casualties for the Allied side, but they have to really think through how they're going to strategically use that information, not give away their hand too much to the Germans that they know this information. That, to me, is this incredibly dramatic thing to have to talk about. And all they kind of show in the movie is like, well, we did a lot of calculus, did some ransom stats, and, you know, kind of...
They show them going to the overseer to explain their predicament, and he tells them how they have to handle it. And I thought they actually handled that element pretty well. I'm with you on Theory of Everything. I thought it was pretty flabby as cinema, but actually I thought Imitation Game and Wild and Foxcatcher are really well-told lean stories with really strong direction as well. So I think those stand up outside of their performances.
I think for me, like with Imitation Game, what they did well. I just wanted a little more of it. I thought that was instantly fascinating, and maybe I'm just interested in, you know, war strategy, let's say, in this instance. I could have taken more.
I'm sorry to hear that The Theory of Everything, at least for you, Chris, wasn't fulfilling, because I haven't seen it yet, but the poignancy of seeing someone portray Stephen Hawking different from what we now know him as. He's almost, people have great respect for him, but he's almost seen as a caricature, right? He's this incredibly smart brain trapped in this body that is very broken. And the thought of seeing him at a time when none of that was an element in his life is intriguing to me.
Yeah, and that's exciting. And Eddie Redmayne is really good as the young Stephen Hawking. It's based on a book written by his ex-wife, and it is kind of a love story about how they met and how they drifted apart a little bit. I thought it served her a little bit more than it served him.
Which is so surprising in a book by an ex-wife.
Exactly.
It's, you know, Redmayne's performance is certainly the most technically impressive one of the year. I mean, this is a guy who's slowly developing ALS. And when you know the backstory of how the movie was made, I find it even more impressive, which is that they didn't necessarily shoot this thing in sequence. So he had to map out scene by scene, you know, okay, if I lose the ability to point my finger in scene A, I can't suddenly regain it in the next scene. And when you're not shooting that sequentially, you have to think, okay, I took that out last time, so I got to keep this all straight in my head. And, oh, by the way, do all that while you're acting with, you know, whoever you're in the scene with. So it was really taken as a whole an impressive just performance on how somebody could keep all that straight in their head.
I think Chris Rock can be really interesting in some of the things he does. How's Top 5?
It's his best movie. And that's not saying all that much on the surface, because Hollywood has never really known what to do with him. I'm not sure if he's ever really known how to translate his amazing comedic talents onto the big screen. So he wrote it, he directed it, he stars in it, I believe he produced it. So it has more of a story than his other movies. He is more him than in his other movies. It is the most Chris Rock movie to date. But it's still not quite as satisfying as seeing him up there doing stand-up. It's got some great stuff in it, though. I gave it a B+. I reviewed it this week. I think it's being overrated a little bit just because we're so happy to see him in a movie that's not horrible.
I've wondered with him, and I will preface this by saying I wasn't able to make the top five screening, but of all the comics I think I've ever seen, he's the one who seems to me the most to pull energy from the audience. It's his give and take if you've ever seen him live or even in a special. And that's, of course, the one thing that's missing when you're making a movie is there is no audience that you can pull that energy from. And I think that's always maybe been the challenge for him is how do you capture that same live feeling when you're taping something.
So a couple of years ago, I was one of the nerds who stood in line with my family to see Les Mis on Christmas Day. I'm not that interested in Into the Woods.
I'm not either, Stephen. Are you, Stephen Hooker, are you interested in
it? You know, I am interested. I unfortunately haven't been able to see it yet. I'm looking forward to it. But what I'm interested to see is, you know, of course, this kind of sounds silly to say, but all musicals, of course, come down to the songs. And this is a musical that's been around for a while, and yet the songs from this, I'm sure there's somebody who loves it, but the songs from this show never quite got above the show to where they just kind of become songs that people know. You know, there's plenty of Broadway songs that we all are familiar with and have never seen the show. I can't think of one from this show, which makes me wonder, like, well, maybe I wonder how strong the songs are. Because if you've got one or two good ones, I mean, heck, as Frozen proved last year, you can certainly build on that. And I think that's going to be the key is, are the songs and the people singing those songs enough to let you ride with all of the kind of fantastical elements that any musical contains.
For my 5-year-old niece, is it true that they're making Frozen 2? Have you guys had confirmation?
I'm sure they are. I don't have confirmation, but when a movie makes that kind of money, like across multiple platforms and everything from kids' clothing to actual box office, I would guarantee that they are making Frozen 2.
Yeah. Well, put it this way. If Disney passed on that, I would like to sign up. In fact, I read recently
I would like stock options.
You know, that movie sold something like $300 million worth of tickets and, of course, countless DVDs. But for every dollar in ticket sales that it sold, it sold about three times that amount in merchandising. So you can only imagine how much that's going into those Disney coffers.
Stephen, you saw Big Hero 6.
I did, just this morning. I got up
wow.
early.
That is really, that's dedication.
I'd like to think so. You know, if you're going to watch something very early, it may as well be an animated movie.
Did you eat like Fruit Loops while you were watching?
it's a serial movie.
You watch more movies before 9 a.m. than most people watch all day.
At least on this day I did. And it was worth getting up early for. Mm-hmm. This is Disney's big entry into the holiday movie season. And it's a story of a kid they don't really say how far in the future, but it's a story of this kid who's a super bright young kid, and he's into gaming. He takes part in these what they call bot battles, which are just like little robots that people fight. He becomes interested in science through his older brother, and who has developed this robot, essentially, that's a healthcare robot. It just goes along diagnosing people, fixing their problems. It's a super cute character. And ultimately, they're trying to track down someone who's stolen this technology they've invented. So that's all interesting of itself. But I find the movie fascinating from just a movie-making perspective because it feels like a movie that was created by a bunch of Disney executives in a boardroom. I mean, the backdrop of it is the city that's literally a mishmash of San Francisco and Tokyo. And the characters in the movie, at least the main characters, look sort of white and sort of Asian and sort of Latino, maybe, depending on whose eyes you're viewing these characters through. And so the more cynical way of looking at it, of course, is like, well, they're just trying to apply to every person who might be out there, sell as many tickets as possible, sell as much merchandise. And I'm sure that's certainly part of the plan. But the more I got to watching it and the more I realized that it's actually a good movie, I began to think, well, is that really such a bad thing that any kid seeing this movie can kind of see themselves in the heroes that are in the film? And, you know, I don't see anything wrong with that.
I want to know if Congress tries to shut down the healthcare robot.
That's not a plot point in this movie, but it takes place in the future, so hard to say.
All right, I know nothing about Winter Sleep, but it is on the like big list right now. Have you guys seen it?
I did. I loved it. But I will preface that by saying it is a 3.5-hour Turkish film. Mm. So if you're into that sort
Date
of thing,
night.
It's about a man who runs a hotel in the Turkish mountains with his wife and his sister, and he's sort of approaching a certain time of life where he starts thinking about what he's done and what he wants to do. And it's about the recriminations that exist between these three characters, mostly. He's a landowner in the area. He has tenants that he leans on in a kind of obtuse way. It's a gorgeous film. It reminded me of a Ingmar Bergman film in its psychological penetration and the way that it's really getting into long dialogue scenes where just really powerful emotional intensity is being expressed.
Well, let me ask you about that. I don't mind a film with subtitles a bit. You know, sometimes I have to drag my kids in. They're like, it's reading. It's not supposed to be right. Reading. It's a movie. But I do always feel like you're losing some nuance in the dialogue, right? So that you can fit everything on the screen at the same time. And if a movie is dialogue heavy, I wonder if that really affects your experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I don't know Turkish. I certainly, just through the subtitles and the occasional English dialogue, which is very occasional, everything that's going on seems to come through loud and clear. I wonder about things like cultural subtext. Like, for instance, this guy, the main character, is writing a history of Turkish theater. And I'm sure there are all these references to Turkish theater in this film that I will never get. But I don't think I really have to appreciate it. It just works on a very human level for me. It's also gorgeous. I mean, it makes you want to go to the Turkish mountains.
And it does make you wonder, with those translations, who is it that's doing the translating? I mean, I'm assuming that, of course, they would hire somebody who they have faith in. But, you know, there's the question of, do you literally translate every single word that the person's saying, or do you translate the meaning of what they're saying? Because sometimes, like you said, Chris, some of those cultural idioms aren't going to come across if you translate it literally. And for me, as a viewer, I would rather them do that little extra work for me if it's going to help me better understand the plot or the character. It doesn't have to be exactly word for word, so long as it's true to what the scene is trying to express.
I always think of the scene in Lost in Translation where Bill Murray is shooting the commercial and the guy's giving him these long instructions, and it's translated as, do more. He had to have said more than that.
We're speaking with Chris Wagner, pop culture writer for the Dallas Morning News, and Stephen Becker of KERA, who happens to be producer of this show, about year-end movies and their thoughts. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
My fellow master builders.
Hello!
Lord Business plans to end the world as we know it. There is yet one hope. The special has arisen.
I know what you're thinking. He is the least qualified person to lead us. And you are right.
Who do you want to be, Mason? What do you want to do?
I want to take pictures. Make art.
What can you bring to it that nobody else can?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Try harder.
There's Bible verse. I think about sometimes, many times, it goes, then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, send me.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. You heard a little montage of some movies from throughout 2014. You heard the Lego Movie, then Boyhood, and finally Fury. What did you guys think about Fury?
I really liked Fury. It was tough. It's a really grimy combat movie that is pretty relentless, nonstop combat. It's four guys in a tank for almost the entire film. And I sort of admired its purity in that sense. I thought the ensemble was great. Brad Pitt, that was Shia LaBeouf. Stephen, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yeah,
you
yeah,
just
yeah.
heard in that dialogue sequence. Michael Pena is also really good. I liked, like I said, there's a certain purity of form to it, and it does not flinch from showing how horrific combat can be. So I am a Fury fan.
I was as well. I only saw it not too long ago, and it's definitely in my top five for the year. I think it's a nice companion piece to American Sniper in a lot of ways. Chief among them is you really get the sense of camaraderie and band of brothers element of these guys who are literally confined to the inside of this tank. I mean, it doesn't get much closer than that. At the beginning of the movie, one of the members of their little squad has been killed in action. They get this new super young kid straight over from the U.S. to join their tank squadron. And there's this long process of them letting them into their world because he hasn't been there through all the fighting that they've done.
Yeah.
And there's some of that in American Sniper as well, in that it's kind of the reverse. Bradley Cooper's character, Chris Kyle, doesn't ever want to leave the action because he feels like he's leaving his brothers in arms, which he literally is, which is why he continues to return tour after tour after tour to the action when, you know, somebody who's not been in that situation might think, oh my gosh, you're finally out of this. Why would you ever go back? Well, these two movies really explore that connection that people who have fought alongside each other have.
I guess that's five guys, right?
Yeah, it's five guys.
It's Logan Lerman and then John Bernthal are the other two. And one, just a brief Fury note, Dallas's own Jim Perrick has a really nice supporting role. He's a local actor who's starting to do some good things.
And just one more thing about Fury. It has one of the best scenes, I think, of the year, which is this new recruit doesn't want to have to fight. I mean, they're finally in a battle, and he does something which I have to imagine other soldiers have done before, which he just says, you know what? I'm going to keep my conscience clear. I cannot fire this gun. I can't shoot that guy. And Brad Pitt, as the leader of the tank, basically forces him to do it, and it's one of the most, you know, kind of hold on to the side of your seat movie scenes I've seen in a long time. And what it really got to for me is, yeah, this, I can understand this kid wanting to keep his conscience clear, but why does that mean that those other guys in the battle aren't allowed to keep their conscience clear? You know, they're doing the dirty work to allow you to somehow keep this clean mind. It's really not fair when it comes down to it. And that scene just brilliantly displays that idea.
Yeah, it's really complicated when you start to think about it that way. Let's go to the phones. I think we have Ed on the line in Arlington with a question about Fury. Is that right, Ed?
Yeah, you pretty much answered my question. I was wondering, I'm a history buff as well as I like good war movies, and I was wondering how Fury compared with some of my favorite war movies, which would be Patton and Glory, if it has anything to offer in comparison to those.
Those are two really different films. Thanks for a call, Ed.
Two very good films, too. Patton's an interesting film. It's really not entirely pro-Patton. I think Francis Ford Coppola wrote the screenplay, and George C. Scott plays Patton. I haven't seen it in years. I'd say it probably has a little more in common with Glory, but it's really a little bit more relentless and grinding, and I mean that in a good way, than either one of those movies. It is pretty much, you know, the claustrophobia and the fear that takes place among these guys, and really, really, I mean, it's the end of World War II, and they're stuck in Germany, and the German army is doing, it's basically, you know, last stand time, some pretty nasty stuff going on.
Lego Movie, you guys like it?
Yeah, Stephen, I liked it. It's been a while.
I loved it.
It's very clever. It is extremely clever. Talk about good songs. That movie has some good songs that I still remember. I hazard to guess they might be better than the Into the Woods song. So yeah, it's a very funny movie, and I think it works for both. It's one of those movies that works for adults and kids, probably on two entirely different levels.
Those are hard to come by.
They are.
Yeah, it's one of the smartest movies of the year. They create this world that's very reflective of the way that people played with Legos. There are scenes where just these Legos that seemingly have nothing to do with each other just show up and populate in the same space. You've got Hobbit Legos next to Unicorn Kitty Legos, and I believe the 2002 NBA All-Star team makes an appearance. But that's how kids play with Legos. You just get the pieces that you have together. There's a 1980s astronaut who only has those cruddy flat Legos that they had in the 80s to build his stuff. But it actually is a really nice message for kids. The main character, who's voiced by Chris Pratt, is the most anonymous, nondescript Lego character in this huge universe, and yet he's the one who's kind of called upon to save the day. And it's a lesson, and again, a nice message for kids that, hey, just because not everyone knows what you're capable of doesn't mean that you're not capable of great things.
Really good year for Chris Pratt, too, between that and Guardians of the Galaxy. This was sort of his coming out.
For sure.
We will continue to see him play that sort of action hero with a sense of humor and a personality. It's fun to watch.
So are we going to see a lot of Boyhood as the Academy Awards season arrives?
I can't imagine that we wouldn't. That's the best movie of the year. It was 12 years in the making, so it certainly deserves its time in the sun. I saw it way back in March at South by Southwest, and while I've seen many other things that I very much enjoyed, I've not seen something that's been better than that this year.
I expect it'll get multiple nominations, and I hope it does. It's actually my favorite movie of the year, too, as much as I hate to agree with Steven Becker.
It's certainly the most impressive just from a logistics standpoint.
Yeah, I just, what I look for when I say, okay, this is the best thing I saw or the one I'll remember, I love movies that do something different that I have not seen before, and I have never seen a film approach the passage of time and growing up, both for kids and adults. I mean, the characters I'm talking about, not the viewers. The way that this movie does, it does something new, and it does it really well. And I just like Linklater a lot, and both as a filmmaker. I think he's really just on a peak now, and he just seems like a dude. And that's what, you don't just meet a lot of filmmakers that are like that. I saw him at the Texas Book Festival last month, or in October, I'm sorry, and he was signing the book, the big deluxe Boyhood book. And I was like, oh, there's Linklater. I wonder if he looks really busy. And I walked by him. He was like, hey, man, what's up? It's just like some guy that I, talked to a few times before, but he remembered me. And he's like, hey, what's going on? Yeah, I'm doing okay. So you got to root for a guy like that. At least I do.
See, I'm no film critic, and I loved the ambition of it, and I loved the effect of watching this boy grow up is really amazing, especially for me as a parent. It's, very poignant. But it did feel a little bit like Linklater wanted to get every scene from his real life into this story, some of which really advanced the story and told you more about the characters, and others which, to me, felt completely extraneous and like, I'm looking at my watch and wondering if my car is about to be towed out on the street from where it was parked.
Yeah, and I've talked to a couple other people who feel that way. I really love the extraneous moments.
Yeah.
It felt very real to me. And yeah, it felt autobiographical as well, and it's may mean more to him than it means to us, but to me, that's part of that passage of time that I'm talking about, the quiet moments that don't necessarily lead to massive plot momentum.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is a movie about capturing and harnessing time, and not every moment in our lives, unfortunately, is super exciting, and I think that the reason to put those little quieter moments in is it keeps the audience guessing a little bit, because you if it just hit... I think what I like about it is, so you have this, they're telling the story of this boy going through adolescence, and it could have hit all of the usual, oh, here's his first kiss, and here's graduation, and here's this, and, he gets his driver's license. And there are some of that, but there's also just the kind of, moments where people actually do grow up between the milestones.
Mm-hmm. Interstellar, what did you guys think of that?
I was not a big fan. I really wanted to be, too. I was really excited for it.
I like that kind of movie, but I didn't think that it actually worked.
It just seemed a little self-important to me. I felt like people were
the
yelling.
2001 references?
A little bit, but at least in 2001, they shut up once in a while. I felt like people were shouting scientific formulas into my ear and then telling me that life is beautiful and we have to cherish it, which I agree, life is beautiful and we have to cherish it, but don't yell it in my ear for 2.5 hours.
Steve?
I thought it was... the perfect casting to have Matthew McConaughey play the scientist astronaut. You wouldn't think on the surface that that would be the case, but we're so used to hearing him say really ridiculous things and just kind of nod your head and be like, oh, okay, yeah, time's a flat circle. Yeah, that makes sense. And then when he's spouting out all this sciencey stuff, it just, I guess coming from his mouth, you kind of like, you're used to rolling with it. But like to Chris's point, it's just way too talky and trying to keep, I don't know, with a, I'm all for a blockbuster that's smart, but this is asking a little bit much.
I liked Inception. That was the,
I did too.
The Chris Nolan movie that a lot of my friends did not like and a lot of critics did not like. I was a big Inception fan. So.
That's the one with the dream and you have to hold a chess piece in your hand.
Yes,
and,
within the dream, within the dream. I went where that took me. I just couldn't quite do that with this one.
And with Interstellar, which, you know, it's still a Christopher Nolan movie and there are still scenes that are incredibly crafted. I mean, particularly towards the end, not to give anything away, but when they kind of enter this additional dimension. I mean, it's incredibly realized on screen. And if you just has taken in little segments like that, there's a lot to appreciate in there. I just don't know that it all came together for me.
Made you want to like put yourself into some kind of artificial hibernation state for chunks of the movie?
Yeah, I almost did.
I think you might have entered one of those states actually at that screening.
Yeah, we, I think, kind of looked at each other and gave the knowing nod, like, what is going on right at this moment?
If somebody's looking for a feel-good film at the end of the year, something from any time this year, where would you send them?
A feel-good movie. I really liked St. Vincent, the Bill Murray movie. I don't think it's a great film, but I think it's kind of a slightly subversive feel-good movie.
Is it Cranky Bill Murray and Cute Kid? Is that what we're looking
at? Cranky Bill Murray and Cute Kid. Mm-hmm. And Naomi Watts, very funny as a Russian prostitute. And Melissa McCarthy sort of playing against type as the straight woman. Not kind of going all over the place and doing slapstick.
I love her, so I'd like to see her actually play something different.
I thought she did a really good job. So yeah, I would say check out St. Vincent.
This is out on DVD now, so if you're looking to catch up on DVD stuff, I would say Grand Budapest Hotel. I mean, that's a movie that I smiled at from beginning to end. It was just so, it's of course Wes Anderson. It stars Ralph Fiennes as this guy who runs the hotel and is just, you know, trying to put out one fire after another. It's a long story, but it, for one thing, it looks great. The color scheme in it is just, I mean, it's one of those movies that you could put on in the background of a party that you were having and people
just
would,
looks
just,
chic and cool.
Would just watch it. Yeah. But that's just, again, one of those movies that you will just smile throughout.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, too. That'll be on my top 10. It's weird. These movies came out so long ago, some of them, and you have to jog your memory a little bit. I think it's a flaw in the system almost that we think so intensively about the final 2 months and the films that come out then. And what about this great film that came out in March or February? It's a weird thing.
All right, we're going to talk ourselves out here on some music from Elf, which is my sort of family tradition now, 21st century family tradition at the holidays.
It's a ginormous tradition.
It's a giant, exactly. You do it while eating. You watch it while eating candy corns and drinking maple syrup. Chris Wagner is pop culture writer for the Dallas Morning News. Stephen Becker is with KERA, and of course he produces this show. They are co-hosts all year round of KERA's Big Screen podcast. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Chris.
As always, thank you.
Think is engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And we want to say a special thanks today to our terrific intern and sometime phone screener, Marshall Noor. Today is her last day with us, and we sure will miss her. You can contact Think at KERA.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
So really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Well, maybe just a half a drink more.
Put some records on while I pour.
The neighbors might think.
Maybe it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this
drink? No cabs to be had out there.